Chapter 14. Girling About. Sparrow always does this, wailed Parsley Catson, who was 10 minutes into a diatribe. She's so thirsty, such a tryhard. Audrey was in no mood for this drama. All Parsley ever talked about was Sparrow Shapiro and Riverdale, and now Audrey was stuck sitting next to her for the next hour, as if detention couldn't get much worse. I wore my new platform booties yesterday, started Parsley. And Sparrow goes, oh, I ordered the same ones from Irvin Outfitters last weekend. Bitch, no, you did not. You just need an alibi for when you come to school wearing my shit. Fighting off an eye roll, Audrey gave the mildest response she could muster. Maybe she did buy them. We all buy the same stuff. Look, we're both wearing the Keith Haring Vans. Vans are ubiquitous, scoffed Parsley, who Audrey suspected didn't know how to spell ubiquitous. This isn't about Sparrow stealing your booties, thought Audrey. This is about Sparrow stealing your bat mitzvah entrance song. As if anyone had the monopoly on Old Town Road. Audrey didn't want to discuss this anymore. The good news was distracting Parsley was easy. Your brows are the cutest. Did you get them microbladed? Yes, at Bling Brows. They're good, right? Iconic. Audrey stifled a yawn. Parsley squealed and then checked her reflection in her iPhone. She stuck out her tongue, threw up a peace sign, and snapped a selfie. I'm so cute. Perfect. Now Audrey could mope in peace. All day she'd been holding back tears. But since her brand was consistently composed, none of the four other kids in Cheshire Prep's strikingly low-stakes detention would have noticed. Audrey could count on one hand the number of times she'd been outwardly bummed at school, or said a really inflammatory cuss word like fuck shit, or trashed a friend behind her back. No one ever knew how she really felt. Audrey Zora Tony Mercy Moore was a leader, after all, and in the wrong hands, this social power could inspire cliquey shenanigans. Thusly, Audrey always tried to seem positive, chill, sane. If her day sucked, she'd just go home, sketch something, read You Are a Badass, How to Stop Doubting Your Greatness and Start Living an Awesome Life, and cuddled in bed with her mom. Audrey's emotions were hers to deal with. Other kids really just wanted to talk about themselves anyway. If you let them unobstructed, they trusted you. Besides, therapists should never introduce their feelings into a session. She'd learned this in third grade while reading Freud's A General Introduction to Psychoanalysis. So despite being stuck in detention and devastated, she was cool. Never mind that the day before her mom had implied that Audrey was the reason she had no life, no love, no real happiness. I'm a robot so you can be a butterfly. Had she always felt like Audrey was holding her back? Had her birth been a mistake? Audrey and her mom had never had an all-out brawl before. They were bickerers, not fighters. But yesterday, in Cheshire Prep's main hallway, her mom had glared at her like she was the catalyst for all the stress, strife, and strain in the world. I'm ruining her life, thought Audrey. I can fix everyone I know but her. And it stung, because Eva was her best friend. Of course Audrey adored her dad and his big, bustling extended family in California. On Sunday, she was flying out to spend the summer in Dadifornia, and she already knew it'd be a blast. Her dad was vacation, though. Eva was home. It had been only the two of them, forever. Girling about, creating inane rituals for the hell of it, taking adventure walks every Saturday, watching mid-century musicals on Wednesday nights, collaging vision boards to manifest Oscar wins, attending drag queen bingo every Easter, ordering the entire menu at their June brunch at La Dorée, steak au poivre, macaron, chocolate eclairs, lavender tea, and a Pepto-Bismol chaser, each year before Audrey's flight to California. Tweens were supposed to hate their moms because most mothers had forgotten how confusing it was to be 12, 13, 14. How pointless and powerless you felt. But Eva got her. She validated her thoughts, her opinions. Besides, she wasn't like other moms. She was like the young, quirky aunt on a network sitcom. The one you ran to when your actual mom was too uptight to discuss Plan B. Audrey idolized her. When Audrey was 4, she tried to hop into the shadow that Eva cast on the walls. What she wouldn't have given to try her on. On her 6th Christmas, she asked Santa to make Eva the same age as her so they could be BFFs. In 2nd grade, she'd snuck up on a napping Eva and colored her entire forearm with a highlighter because she was important. On days when Eva was too busy to notice, she snuck her special ring out of her room and wore it. To be like her, and to feel protected by mommy magic. And to this day, insomniac Audrey still crawled into bed with her, every night around 3 a.m. And Eva, usually balancing an ice pack on her head, big spooned her back to sleep, her warm hand cupping her cheek. Her sheets always smelled of the peppermint and lavender oils she rubbed on her head at night. Audrey loved sinking into this scent. And if Eva wasn't in too much pain, she'd sing her an old lullaby. Do, do, ti, bébé, coule la rivière, coule la rivière, coule. Eva didn't speak Creole, so she sang it in a bastardized phonetic way, do, do, ti, bébé. Neither one of them knew what the song meant, but it didn't matter. This was when the good sleep started, the peppermint and lavender dodo sleep. Audrey's thoughts slowly ratcheted up from miserable to indignant. She thinks I'm a burden. As if it were so easy being Eva's daughter, a babysitter for a 12-year-old, constant check-ins, even if she was just walking to a friend's house. And then there was the whole cursed thing. When Atticus Seidman texted the entire class a gross scene from Book 6 of Cursed, Audrey had to play along, when all the while her soul was cringing. The sex itself didn't freak her out. Audrey was raised by a mom who used the correct words for private parts, was consistently honest about where babies came from, and championed masturbation. Self-love is paramount. Sex was natural. But her mom writing about it wasn't. Gross. She was so asexual. She was just mommy, cuddly, and cute. It was like imagining Pikachu writing porn. Earlier that year, Ophelia Gray's mom had forbidden her to attend Audrey's birthday party because Eva was a smut peddler. Audrey, despite her embarrassment, would defend Eva to the death. She told Ophelia that her mom was repressed and suggested she try a dildo called the quarterback, which she'd read about on bitchmedia.org. Eva had been furious with her. But after bedtime, Audrey had heard her repeating the story to Auntie Cece and giggling till she cried. Audrey was proud of her mom, unconditionally. But because of one mistake, Eva was no longer proud of Audrey. What else could she do to please that woman? She was a model student. She'd never kissed a boy. Yes, she'd tried a jewel at Brooklyn Bowl's teen night, but she'd barely even felt anything until she went home and ate her entire bag of Halloween candy during the span of a 6-minute YouTube cheek contouring tutorial. Eva didn't know how lucky she was having a daughter like her. If Audrey couldn't make her happy, nothing would. If living a dry, dateless life was good enough for her, then fine. But it wasn't Audrey's fault. She hadn't asked to be born. She'd learned this lesson from a powerful codependency-themed episode of Ianla, Fix My Life. Plus, the threat of being expelled wasn't the end of the world. Audrey was having second thoughts about her private school anyway. It just wasn't real. She was secretly dying to go to public school to experience true oppression. There she could affect the most change. How can I say I'm a plugged-in cultural force when I'm surrounded by so much useless affluence, she thought. Private school is a dated, classist concept. She was stifled at Cheshire Prep. And maybe that was the difference between Eva and Audrey. Eva accepted being stifled. But Audrey wanted to taste life, feel it, do stuff, go places. Be an adventurous woman. Like Auntie Cece or Grandma Lizette. Audrey wished she knew Grandma Lizette better. They FaceTimed on birthdays and holidays, but she'd visited Brooklyn only a couple of times. Eva said Lizette had a fear of flying. Plus, they were always too busy with school and work to travel much. But Audrey always wondered why Grandma Lizette wasn't in their lives more. In Eva's stories, Lizette sounded divine. Too beautiful, too unique, too powerful for the world. When Audrey's contemporary art teacher assigned their final project to paint a feminist icon, she knew she'd paint her grandmother. Lizette, who'd won a zillion titles in the notoriously racist, misogynist pageant industry, and with no education or resources, launched a career as a model and traveled the globe with her daughter. Eva was always talking about the years she'd spent in Switzerland. All that, and then Grandma Lizette had managed to send her daughter to Princeton, too. What couldn't she do? Grandma Lizette was a true American success story. She would have loved me, Audrey mused, her thoughts drowning out Parsley's tirade about whatever. As Audrey continued to plummet, the supervising TA, Mr. Josh, was quietly freaking out. His blonde pompadour was sweaty at the hairline, and his peaches and cream complexion had flushed a ruddy red. All session, he'd been glued to book Twitter on his phone, following gossipy tweets with links from LitHub, Literary Gossip Blog, BookBiz, etc. Now he was pacing back and forth in front of the whiteboard, waiting for an opportunity to interrupt the girls. Parsley finally paused for breath, and then, summoning all the prep school charm that kept him afloat at Vanderbilt while he really wanted to grow his hair to his knees, climb Mount Kilimanjaro, and write about the journey like a male Cheryl Strayed, he approached Audrey's chair.
"Hello, girls. How are you holding up?"
"We're good, Mr. Josh," said Audrey. "Are we talking too much?"
"No, no, you're fine.
Audrey, could I speak with you for a moment?"
Her heart sank.
God, what did she do now? Pasting on a smile, she said, "Sure, is everything okay?"
"No, no, you're great. It's just, sorry, I'm nervous."
He shook his whole body like a wet dog and started over.
"Audrey, your mom knows Shane Hall?"
Frowning, she asked, "Who?"
"Shane Hall, the novelist. He wrote 8 and Seesaw."
"Oh, him." She wrinkled her nose. Shane Hall wrote what she called F-Train books, the hardcovers grown-ups toted on the subway to flex that they were reading an important and culturally relevant book. Audrey was a compulsive reader, but wasn't into F-Train books. She knew about him, though.
"Didn't he have a DUI or something?" asked Audrey. "It was on TMZ, I think. My mom wouldn't know someone like that."
"Shane Hall?" mused Parsley. "His name sounds like a dorm."
"I think your mom definitely knows him," said Mr. Josh, thrusting his iPhone in Audrey's face. There was Audrey's mom snuggling up to Shane Hall on a bench, eating ice cream, looking happier than Audrey had ever seen her look. A different kind of happy. The kind of happy that is, in fact, reflective of a person living their best life. The kind of happy that isn't at all held back by a bothersome daughter.
"His mommy dating this man?" she wondered, her mind a swirl of confusion and hurt. "Is she in love? What was that 'who has time to date' speech about then? Why did she lie to me? She's out there happy AF while I'm feeling guilty?"
"Anyway," continued Mr. Josh, who Audrey had forgotten was in the room, "Shane Hall is my favorite author, and I have a manuscript that I'd kill to get in his hands. I have it on a thumb drive. Do you think if I gave it to you, you could pass it to your mom?"
And then for the first time in her school career, Audrey let go. "Quick question, Mr. Josh," she said.
"Yes?"
"What in the actual fuck shit is my life?" she wailed. Then she apologized and burst into tears.
Chapter 15. Dream House.
For two cynical skeptics like Eva and Shane, the dream house upon entrance was a bit too earnest. Dream House rules.
Welcome to the Dream House. No smoking, vaping, eating, drinking, cell phone use, picture taking, talking above a whisper, touching, or exchanging of bodily fluids permitted. This is a safe space. Don't make it weird. Please store valuables in a locker. If you're in a private room, feel free to close the door, but there are no locks. Each person is assigned a freshly washed pillow and blanket via our eco-friendly laundry service. Please toss in the linen basket when you're done. When your hour is up, your sleep guide will give you a gentle nudge. Please do not strike the sleep guide. He, she, they are simply doing his, her, their job. And what's your job, you ask? To do three things. Relax, restore, recharge.
And flights of angels sing thee to thy rest. Hamlet. Upon entry, a gazelle-like sleep guide handed them freshly laundered plush pillows and blankets. Assuming that they were a couple, she led them toward a private room. Tucked in the first two floors of a classic Edwardian brownstone, the Warren of Rooms was, indeed, a soporific sleep chamber. Silence was optional, so some light whispers could be heard above the soft, ambient, hard-to-place tonal soundtrack. The smoky sweet scent of incense wafted unobtrusively through the halls, each room bathed in darkness except for the drowsiness-inducing images projected on the walls. One room seethed with gently pulsing blue dots. Another room glowed burnt sienna, thanks to a crackling bonfire projected on the wall. It was so realistic, Eva almost felt the toasty warmth as she walked by. People dozed on the floor, lying on massive body pillows, their skin glowing in different colors. In one room, a woman snored softly. A guy in an ill-fitting suit lay next to her, lips murmuring a soundless chant, or prayer. Maybe he was reciting the lyrics to Lizzo's Truth Hurts. Who knew? The point was, he was relaxed. Eva couldn't imagine dozing off within the next hour. Sleep called for 5 milligrams of Ambien, an ice pack, a painkiller shot, and her white noise app. But the trippy hippie vibe was soothing. Damn near sublime. The best part was that it was an unexpected twist, like Alice toppling down the rabbit hole or Dorothy nodding out in Oz's poppy fields. When she set out to see Shane this morning, she definitely hadn't imagined ending up in a hazy, hypnotic funhouse at 2:50 p.m. With her daughter, her career, and her life in tatters, Eva had no business wasting an hour in this place. But here she was, lost to the world. It felt like what happened here didn't count in real life. And then there was Shane. She wasn't ready to say goodbye again. She was aching to make their afternoon last. There was no way to pretend that her day with Shane, though platonic, wasn't the biggest thrill she'd had in forever. It was so easy, scarily so. Eva felt a jolt in her personality around him. Shane was pulling her back to her real self. All the goofy, random, raw, dark moments she usually hid were on full display. And he drank it all in. The give and take of luring him in and allowing herself to be lured. God, it was exhilarating. She'd forgotten the way they existed in each other's space. That old current was still there, buzzing in the air between them. Eva was dizzy with it. Wanted to suck it into her veins, she felt daring and flirty, jolted awake after too many years of being afraid to feel anything. And if she never saw Shane again after today, she'd be fine. Today was enough. Stay tuned for this and other lies on Fox News at 8, she thought. When they arrived at their room, Eva spread their blankets on the matted floor. Shane fluffed the pillows, and then they lay down. And that was when two cynical skeptics became very, very sleepy. Eyes feeling heavy, Eva glanced around the cozy, if borderline claustrophobic room. It was the size of a modest walk-in closet. Neon lights reading Night Night decorated the ceiling, pulsing a low, hazy violet-blue glow. 4 beats on, 4 beats off. like a heartbeat. The color turned their skin a surreal, soothing violet.
Eva turned to face Shane, fluffing the pillow under her cheek. He lay flat on his back, one hand tucked behind his head. She watched him watching the flashing words. Soon his lids shuttered, his lashes resting on his cheekbones.
"I need a room like this in my house," he murmured.
"Where's your house?"
"Well, yeah, I need to get one first."
He opened his eyes, turning his head toward her. "I could never decide where I wanted to stay. Before I started teaching, I'd move twice a year.
Nairobi, Siargao, Copenhagen, any place near water. Laos. I went on a motorcycle trek there once. Vietnam has the most dramatic terrain, jungles and mountains and waterfalls. Technicolor green grass. You feel like the topography's happening to you.
Did you know over there they call the Vietnam War the American War?"
"As well they should," said Eva, cozying her cheek into the pillow.
"What's your favorite place?"
"Tagazout, a shipping village in Morocco," he said, no hesitation. "A 9-year-old kid taught me how to surf there."
"Your life sounds made up, I swear."
"It's true," he insisted. "And I was good. I ripped my stomach open on coral, though. Probably should have gotten stitches, but I had to act cool in front of this little dude, who was fearless. He was surfing before he could talk, missing a pinky finger, tatted up, a fucking pirate. Anyway, I duct taped it together and it healed crazy."
"There wasn't any Neosporin in this town? Let me see the scar."
It was almost pitch black, but Eva could feel Shane smirk. "You're asking me to take off my shirt?"
"God, no," she bit her lip.
"Just pull it up."
"You asking or telling?"
"Telling."
He looked at her for a moment with an air-crackling gaze, then reached behind his back and pulled his shirt off completely. In the dark, she made out a puffy, jagged scar snaking across his stomach. More vividly, she saw his strong arms and chest and his lightly muscled abs, and all that smooth, deep sienna skin stretching down, down, to the barest happy trail disappearing into his jeans. Jesus! Eva wanted to suck the skin there so badly, just above his jeans.
"Why are you such a thirst trap?"
"You forced me to do this," Shane whispered into the dark, pulling his shirt back over his head.
"Go to sleep."
"I can't sleep," she murmured. "I'm distracted."
"Why?"
He turned his head to face her, and then their eyes locked in silent conversation. It was all so dreamlike. Minutes were melting into each other. Their blinks became slower, the two of them wearing syrupy, satisfied smiles. Finally, Eva delivered an answer that neither of them believed.
"I'm trying to memorize this room. It's good material. Maybe it'll show up in a book," she said, yawning faux drowsily.
"Honestly, as stressful as writing is, I can't imagine not doing it."
"It's heady, right?" he muttered, eyes focused on her mouth.
"Yeah, the power's so good. Making complete strangers laugh, cry, get turned on. It's better than sex."
"Is it, though?"
"I wouldn't remember, actually," she admitted. "I'm at the sexual equivalent of rock bottom. It's been ages."
"You? But you're such a filthy writer."
"I have a filthy imagination," she corrected. "And sometimes it's enough," she thought. "Mostly, it's lonely." Cece had once diagnosed Eva as touch-starved. One of her authors wrote a self-help book about it. When someone went too long without touch, they became hypersensitive to the slightest graze. There was truth to it. Last weekend, Eva had almost had an orgasm when her hairstylist shampooed her, and her hairstylist was a grandmother of 6. Eva had been consciously avoiding Shane's touch all day. If he so much as brushed up against her, she might explode.
"I'm at rock bottom, too," said Shane. "I've never had sober sex."
Eva gasped. That long? Why?
Shane didn't know how to answer this. He'd had a lot of sex, with too many women, in increasingly depraved ways, a lot of it good, most of it a blur. And it was a relief to stop. Normal, healthy people didn't use sex as a post-vodka chaser.
Never got around to it, he said.
I don't miss it, Eva said with a dismissive flick of her wrist. Honestly, I'm practically a virgin again. It'd probably hurt. I'm so backed up, it'd be over in 2 seconds.
Good thing we're not having sex.
I, for one, am relieved, said Shane, with a wolfish smile. Eva giggled into her palm despite herself.
Why is it still so easy to talk to you?
Shane gazed at her until the glint in his eye faded a bit.
Always was. It's just who we are.
Do you remember everything? She whispered. About us?
It took him a while to answer. It's funny, the past decade is a blur, but I remember every detail of that week.
I was hoping I'd romanticized it over the years, that we weren't real.
Her words sounded delicate, breakable.
There was the quietly hypnotic faint sound of a piano, and the incense swirled softly. And then Eva felt a familiar pull. Just like when they were 17, there was no space between them. There was an overwhelming need to get closer. Always. Unthinking, Eva slipped her hand into his. Shane squeezed it and then brought her hand to his mouth, pressing a lingering kiss into her palm. She gasped, electricity tearing through her. It was the slightest touch, but she felt it everywhere. Eva had been imprisoned in pain for so long, she'd forgotten how good feeling good was. Her entire body roused. Suddenly, she was aware of everything, her skin, her cells, the bones under her skin, heart fluttering, core throbbing, touch-starved. Shane watched her reaction with lidded eyes. Then he lightly ran his lips along the inside of her wrist. She let out the tiniest whimper, her back arching. It was electric. Breathless and embarrassed by her reaction, she sat up, burying her face in her hands. No. They were in a public space. Behind an unlocked door, she was a mother, and Shane was a bold-faced name. Were they really fated to get caught dry-humping at an art world pop-up? The welcome sign said, no touching. If they got caught, book Twitter would implode. Audrey would fling herself into the East River. But then she opened her eyes. There was Shane, gazing up at her, looking for all the world like the reckless, irresistible boy he'd once been. But now with experience and grown man gravitas and a rugged North African scar and the most fuckable crinkles around his eyes. And nothing mattered. There was no hell she wouldn't risk for this man, and he knew it. Come here, he said. Eva straddled him, her hair flailing in his face. Shane ran his hands up the backs of her thighs and over her ass. And then, not gently, he gripped her hips and pulled her down against him. Their lips were inches away from each other. 20 questions, he whispered. Go. Why do you really come to see me? To ask for the favor. Liar. Shane tossed her over onto her back, pinning her wrists above her head with one hand. Instinctively, her legs drew up, wrapping around his waist. Why do you come? For you.
Her hips stuttered against his, desperate for friction.
Wanted you.
You got me, he rasped, leaving hot, sucking kisses down her throat. Your turn. Eva trembled beneath him. His mouth scrambling her brain, she couldn't ask Shane the obvious questions. Where'd you go? Why'd you leave? How could you?
Over the years, she'd trained herself not to care about these answers. Besides, this moment wasn't about him. It was about her. So she went for something easier. Do you ever think of me?
Lightly, he ran his tongue along her neck, up to her ear, nibbling on her lobe. I never learned how to stop.
Oh,
she said, and then shakily added,
Your turn.
So, did you romanticize us? Asked Shane, eyes catching hers. Or were we real?
We were real,
she whispered, almost inaudibly. Then, he ground himself against her and she moaned.
Yes, she gasped. Then, and now.
Abruptly, Shane freed her wrists and cradled her face. She slid her hands up his back, gripping his shoulders. Slowly, he lowered his face toward hers, then stopped. He dipped down, then paused. He'd been waiting a lifetime to have her like this, buzzing for him, craving him, desperate, and he wanted to savor it. But she let out an impatient groan, digging her nails into his shoulders, and Shane caved. He crashed his mouth into hers, drawing her into a luscious, searing kiss. The delicious shock of it was enough to make Eva freeze, but then she melted into him, lost in the heat of his mouth, the slide of his tongue, the teasing nip of his teeth, until she was unable to form a coherent thought beyond yes and want and Shane, Shane, Shane. He kept at it, kissing her senseless. It went backward in intensity, slowing down to a soft, searing smolder, almost too hot to take. They stopped only to catch their breath. One more question, he said. We're still playing? She wet her lips with her tongue. Yeah. Shane glanced toward the door, then back down at her, eyes glinting in the dark wickedly. Are you still bad?
Yes,
she said without thinking, reaching down to palm his dick, huge and hard in his jeans. She rubbed along the length of him, teasing out a low groan.
Are you?
Yeah, he said, pushing her dress up and slipping off her strapless bra. Dipping down, he ran his soft, hot mouth along the swell of her breast, his teeth catching on her nipple. He swirled his tongue around it, sucking deliciously, and then, his stubble scraping her skin, he dragged his mouth to the other. Her helpless, shuddery gasps were making him so hard. He wondered how he'd survive this. Yeah, he growled against her breast. I'm still bad.
Why? Tell me.
Shane lifted his head, taking her in. Eva looked radiant, so slutty with her dress pulled up under her arms, showing off sheer panties, curls everywhere, panting, trembling, lips raw and swollen from kissing. She had a bruise blossoming on her hip where he'd gripped her. 'Cause I'm old enough to know better, said Shane, drawing her into a quick, dirty tongue kiss. But I'm gonna do it anyway.
Do what?
Fuck you. Here. And then they tore into each other, frantically. Shane managed to get her soaked panties off one leg, and Eva pushed down his jeans and boxers. But there was no time to get all the way naked. He dug into his wallet for an ancient condom, offering a silent prayer to several deities that it still worked, and slipped it on. Then, covering her with his tall, strong body, Shane sank into Eva with excruciating slowness, careful not to hurt her. It did hurt, but the burn was exquisite. Wanting more, Eva cupped his ass and pushed him deeper. She gasped, and Shane kissed her quiet, driving into her with steady, deep strokes, and all she could do was take it, wave after wave of pleasure. When he felt her whole body begin to shudder against his, he slid his hand down between their sweet, slick, half-clothed bodies and dipped his middle finger over her clit. He rubbed her slowly but fucked her hard. And it was so good, so intense, that it sent her over the edge, shattering her to stillness. And when Shane followed seconds later, he put his mouth to her ear and finally said it. Eva. He rasped, voice wrecked. Eva, Eva. He uttered it like an incantation, the only name that ever mattered. And Eva, heart slamming into her ribs, clung to him in the violet-tinged darkness, feeling both lost and found. Later, Eva regretted it. Not the sex. She regretted leaving Shane there alone in that room, getting up, throwing on her clothes, grabbing her bag, and rushing out. Not saying goodbye. But really, what did he expect? Eva had trained herself not to care why Shane had abandoned her. Instead, she took it as a lesson. Ever since that day 15 years ago, she'd never allowed herself to be left again. Husband, hookup, long-lost lover, it didn't matter. Eva always left first.
Chapter 16. No Safe Thrill. Over the years, Eva had tried to forget her teenage week with Shane. And honestly, much of it was lost, due to her vodka-drenched, pill-obliterated, weed-smoked state. This was what she remembered. She remembered standing in front of the bathroom mirror, gingerly touching her darkened eye, fingering her hacked-off hair. With a mournful sigh, she'd tried to pull it into a pony, but it wouldn't reach. And then Shane appeared behind her in the mirror. "I look like an electrocuted poodle," she sighed. He fought off a smile. "Go ahead, laugh," she said. "I look funny."
"No, you're funny," he said. "Look, you could have hair down to the floor. You could be bald. I could be blind. You'd still be pretty, Genevieve."
He said it like his opinion was fact. Her skin flushed fever hot, and her palms went humid. Shane backed up and leaned against the doorway. Genevieve turned around to face him.
"You pronounced my name right," she said.
"Been practicing."
"Say it again."
"Genevieve," he said with a smile. "It sounds like it tastes good."
"How can a word taste good?"
"Synesthesia. It's when you're overstimulated and your senses get confused. You see music, hear colors, taste words."
"Oh."
Her mouth went dry. She blinked and he was in front of her. The sink pressed against the small of her back. She held her breath. Gently, Shane cupped his good hand behind her neck, his gaze traveling from her eyes to her mouth. Then, for the first time, he kissed her. A lingering, pillowy peck. Innocent. He deepened it then, slanting his casted arm across her back and pinning her to him.
"You do taste good," he said, drawing back a little.
"So much thank you."
Flustered, she said the words out of order. Shane's eyes flickered and he seemed both smug and charmed. Then he dipped down to kiss her some more. She remembered her mom calling on and off for a good 2 days. She never answered, but she kept the bulky Nokia phone on the charger just in case of what, she wasn't sure. On the third day, she moved it into the kitchen downstairs so she wouldn't hear the buzzing. She remembered her first non-self-administered orgasm. They were lying out in the grass by the pool in their underwear, roasting in the swampy DC heat. Shane was listening to her ramble about how Carrie and the Exorcist represented the male fear of female puberty.
"I secretly want to get a period, just once," he said as he popped a whore pill on his tongue and tenderly kissed it into her mouth. "What's up with you and horror?"
"It's an escape."
He trailed kisses along her jawline, down her neck, pausing at her jugular. He murmured against her skin,
"Keep talking."
"It's a safe way to feel."
"Feel what?"
"Intensity," she breathed. "A thrill without being in actual danger."
He sucked the skin above her collarbone into his mouth. Then he bit her. Hot, wet, hard. Electricity bolted through her and she let out a quivery cry. Shane's eyes flickered.
Lightly, he cupped her throat with his hand, ghosting his lips over her as he said, "There is no safe thrill."
He squeezed her throat and she went boneless. Christ. She didn't know this was something to need.
His mouth traveled, restless over her skin, down to where she was drenched. Then he sucked her till she shattered, tearing fistfuls of grass from the earth. She remembered walking in Adams Morgan at sunset. When it started to rain, Shane broke into a parked Chevy Nova, using that mysterious ATM card, to wait it out. He was behind the wheel, Genevieve was shotgun, and they snorted lines of party powder off Shane's paperback copy of Paul Beatty's White Boy Shuffle. Something had been weighing on her mind, and she didn't know how to bring it up. She tried and failed several times, but now feeling electric with coke confidence, she dove right in.
"Gotta ask you something," she started.
"Yeah? What's up?"
"You a virgin?"
"Virginity is a social construct," he said proudly.
"Seriously," she said, rubbing her burning nose.
"Are you?" No. He looked vaguely uncomfortable. "Are you?"
"No," she said. What she meant was, "No, Shane, I'm not a virgin because I was closing my register at Marshall's last summer and the tall, dead-eyed stock guy who never acknowledged me in public asked me to chill, so he smoked a bowl in his mom's basement, and I asked him not to put it in, but he did. And afterward, he high-fived me for not crying. No, Shane, I'm not a virgin. I'm the kind of girl who went back for more because I told myself he thought I was special. I'm not a virgin. I'm the queen of delusion and boys lie, but I believe. So please, oh please, be careful with me."
"Ask?"
Shane was saying something.
"Sorry, what?"
"I said, why do you ask?"
Instead of answering, she bit her lip, shrugging coquettishly. And then she grabbed his face, kissing him until it escalated into a desperate makeout session. A Tipper Gore lookalike pounded on the window, shouting, "Go home!"
Genevieve peered at her over Shane's shoulder, clicked open the blade of her pocket knife, and grinned. Bra strap in his teeth, Shane gave Tipper the finger. The woman clutched her purse and hurried away. They hated everyone who wasn't them. She remembered that sometimes Shane would wake up fighting. He'd punch at the air, sweating, tangled up in the sheets. Instinctively, she'd run the tips of her fingers over his chest, arms, back. Any skin she could reach. Tracing the infinity sign over and over, little figure eights till he slept. It was the only thing that calmed him. This memory was the faintest. It wasn't until years later when Shane published Eight that it came rushing back. She remembered lying in the fetal position on the bed, her brain shrieking, waiting for her cocktail of narcotics to kick in. Sunset bathed the room in a warm, strawberry amber glow. Shane was lying face down in a dusty corner, playing Scrabble with himself. Brow furrowed, lips pouting, he mumbled, "Fuck, I'm just so hard to beat." She stared until she glanced up, face aglow with violet bruises. "You're beautiful," she purred. With a drowsy smirk, he began to croon the Christina Aguilera power ballad. She gasped and then burst into delighted laughter because, god damn it, he did sound like Genuine. Groaning, Shane folded in on himself with boyish self-consciousness, tucking his face into his tee, like it was a new thing letting his guard down, like his goofy side and absurd vocal range was for her only. She drifted off, helplessly endeared, forgetting that she was a stolen girl stealing moments in a stolen house, and sooner or later she'd have to pay. She remembered going on a 7-Eleven run around 2 a.m. and sneaking off with a zillion Hostess treats. Together they took the bus to the Berry Farm area of southeast D.C., the site of Shane's court-ordered home. The Wilson Children's Shelter was a county-owned one-story building on a broken-down block. She couldn't believe people lived there. It looked like an abandoned Staples. Under the guise of night, they snuck in through a janitor's entrance. While Eva waited in a hallway that smelled of bleach and piss, Shane slipped into the crowded bedrooms, leaving a Twinkie under each kid's pillow. Then they slipped out. Afterward, they sat on a bus stop bench a couple of blocks away. One cracked street lamp lit the block. A siren went off endlessly. I wish I could protect them. They're innocent, you know. Actually, Mike and Junior are fucking menaces, but in a pure way.
You're pure.
Chewing the inside of his cheek, he looked at her. If you knew about me, you wouldn't like me anymore. Resting her chin on his shoulder, she slipped her arms around him.
How do you know I like you?
His smile flickered, then faded. I had parents once, he continued quietly. Foster parents from when I was a baby to about 7. I really loved them. They loved me back, too. One day I was doing dumb shit, wearing my Superman cape and jumping off the counter. I broke my arm. My foster mom drove me to the ER. She was scared because you could see the bone and I was losing a lot of blood. She ran a red light and crashed into an intersection. She died. I didn't. After that, my foster dad acted like I didn't exist. Then he sent me away. Who wants to live with the kid who killed their wife? Genevieve, too struck to answer, gently curled her arm through his and held his hand. She squeezed, offering absolution the only way she could. Anyway, the kids in there, I don't want them to get locked up like me. The more times you go, the harder it is to tell yourself you don't belong there. Prison is the school of the unlearned lesson. He paused. I'll probably go back a third time.
I won't let it happen, she promised. What do you like to do besides fight?
Write.
Don't fight, write.
She cuddled closer.
There, a mantra to keep you out of trouble.
Don't fight, write.
Right.
She kissed him to bless it. She remembered that they were never sober. Shane drank to seek oblivion. She stayed high to outrun pain. They did it together, but she cut herself in private. In the bathroom, daily, she'd sterilize her blade with alcohol pads and then carve a few lines on her upper thigh or upper arm, mostly just deep enough for beads of bright crimson to bubble up in a perfect row. She went into a dissociative trance when she did it, the world slowing, the burn slicing through her pain. A blessed relief each time. Shane saw her cuts.
I don't judge, he'd said. But soon, his eyes started to linger over her tortured skin, clouding with concern. They both had their twisted compulsions, different corners of the same hell. Once, though, she woke up in face-melting migraine pain and begged him to press her slashes. He didn't want to, but he did. She doubled over, gritting her teeth, and when Shane crushed her into his arms, she felt his chest quicken, and his tears dampened her cheeks. She remembered lying under a shady tree in Rock Creek Park toward the end. Their cycle of highs and come-downs was beginning to fray her nerves, and her pain was getting worse. She'd just vomited behind a tree. Now her head was in Shane's lap, and he was rubbing her temples with her lavender oil. Do you miss your mom? He asked.
Yes.
No, she said. It's a relief being away from her. She tries to be good, but she doesn't take care of me. And she has shit taste in men. Does she know how sick you are, G? If my kid would- Don't talk bad about her! She slapped her hands over her face and burst into tears, so violently it shocked them both. Hey, I won't. I'm sorry, she sounds dope. Don't cry. Gently he pulled her into his lap and cradled her against his chest. Fuck it, cry. Eventually, the steady thrumming of his heartbeat lulled her quiet. A few hours and Percocets later, she felt good enough to walk back to the house. Why do you hate your mom's dudes? They hurt her, she said plainly. The world was buzzing and popping.
A flock of pigeons passed above them squawking, but they sounded miles away.
Do they hurt you?
She shrugged.
Some of them do.
The current one, her boss at the bar?
He tried. I pushed him off me and he fell out drunk. I can handle myself.
What's his name?
She told him.
What's the name of the bar?
She stopped on the sidewalk. Shane did too, peering down at her with an expression that could melt a rock. She told him.
She remembered waking up that night and seeing that Shane was gone. He didn't come back that night or the next day. She waited for him, dusting shelves, scrubbing bathrooms, taking showers, torturing her arms, sleeping. Was he gone forever? Had he hurt himself? Jesus Christ, was he in jail again? If he was, she'd sent him there. That night she woke up to a thunderstorm raging outside. She'd left the terrace door open and that side of the room was soaked. So was Shane, who was leaning against the bedroom door. He was all bone and lean muscle and sopping wet t-shirt and soggy broken cast with a fresh cut across the side of his neck. She sat up in bed and he didn't move, just looked at her with hooded, dilated eyes, his chest rising and falling in a violent staccato. He won't bother you anymore. And this is how she knew she was as crazy as he was. Her fear evaporated, and all she felt was a perverse, potent throb, making her squeeze her thighs together. He slayed dragons she couldn't. He was a fucking outlaw. And she wanted that power inside her. Good girls were supposed to want a prom kiss from the quarterback, not a face fuck from the hot psycho. But she supposed she wasn't good, because she was on Shane in seconds, ripping down his soaked jeans and boxers, draining him till he was weak and she was full. She remembered standing on the terrace at dusk, gazing three stories down into the pool. She knew she'd taken too much of something, because she was in a state of both syrupy wonder and creeping hysteria. Plus, her pain was so vivid that she could barely follow her own thoughts. But the thoughts were loud. Everything felt so out of control. Her dependency on Shane suddenly terrified her. When he disappeared, she'd felt herself dissolving. What if he hadn't come back? And what about after this? This house, this adventure, what was the plan? Would he want her when it was over? She lost things. She'd lost her health. She'd lost Princeton. She'd surely lose her mom after this. She'd lose Shane, too. Boys left after they slept with you. It was why she hadn't slept with Shane yet. Shane was her lighthouse. If he went dark, she'd be lost, treading black water forever. I won't survive this, she thought, stroking the smooth plastic encasing her pocket knife. This pain, it's too much. Maybe she'd just let go then. She climbed up on the middle horizontal bar of the railing and leaned far over, waiting for gravity to take her. But then she felt Shane's hard, casted arm encircle her chest, knocking the wind out of her and yanking her back into the room. He dropped her on the bed and then climbed next to her, grabbing her jaw with his good hand. The fuck you doing? He shook her. She blinked hazily, her eye sockets hurt from knuckling them in her sleep, trying to relieve the insistent stabbing in her temples. She wondered why she bothered. Don't die, baby. Give me a reason. Me, he rasped. Stay for me. Selfish. I am. He slipped his arm under her shoulders, pressing her to him. I need you so you can't die. Just let me. With a desperate groan, he dropped his face into the hollow of her shoulder and begged. Stay. I'll make it worth it. I'll make it so fucking good, Genevieve. You'll be so happy, I swear. Just give me your pain. I'll take it all. Promise to stay, and I'll never leave. Me and you forever, promise me. Her eyes fluttered open. She didn't want to promise with words. She somehow untangled herself from Shane's arms, pushing him backward and straddling him. She reached for her knife, flipped it open, and grabbed a lighter off the nightstand. With unsteady hands, she dipped the blade in the flame. Shane's chest rose sharply, then froze. Carefully, she carved a jagged, sloppy S on her forearm, right below her elbow crease. It was just deep enough to spill droplets of blood on his chest. Shane reached for the fifth of vodka on the nightstand, downed it, then offered her his good arm. She dipped the blade in the fire again and scratched out a crooked G in the same place on his arm. The hurt was intense, but they were so wasted, it buzzed. Just another thing to feel. With a feral growl, he flipped her over and the rest was chaos. Ravenous kissing, sucking, biting, clawing. And then Shane sinking into her. Fucking her like he was giving her a reason to live. He didn't stop till she fell apart beneath him. Soaring, shaking, sobbing. And utterly, wholly his. She remembered waking up in an airtight embrace. A familiar scent enveloped her and she nuzzled deeper into it. As the fog of unconsciousness lifted, she recognized the scent. White diamonds and black drama. It was her mom, mascaraed tears streaming from her movie star eyes. In the light of day, the room looked like a crime scene. The sheets were a mess, empty bottles cluttered the floor, pills and powder dusted the nightstand. She was covered in love bites, scratches and cuts, her S hidden behind gauze. A furious Korean-American chick with a Dior saddlebag was shrieking into a cell phone. Medics and cops swarmed around the bed and an IV needle jutted from her inner elbow, attached to a saline bag. She heard someone say she'd overdosed. "You're lucky to be alive," said the disembodied voice.
"Alive, yes. Lucky, no."
Where's Shane?"
"Who is Shane?" drawled Lizette distractedly.
"Obey. If I can't make them stay, you can't. Mercier women are cursed. Cursed."